How do you go on after that? Today, nobody bats an eye when you hear someone has the flu. It can still be dangerous for older people, but most of them get well. In 1918, it was nearly always fatal, and it went after young people. More soldiers and sailors died from flu than from the war. It happened fast. First, a handful of sailors were sick. 5 days later, 200 men were down with it. Another few weeks, and thousands were dying. When it spread to the city, there weren't enough doctors and nurses to take care of all the sick people, partly because the doctors were dying too. Not that there was much anyone could do. There was no medicine. Getting well was luck, pure and simple. Or God's will, if you believe in a God who kills children and babies. The flu was fast, too. Someone would leave the factory with a headache, and 2 days later, Levine would see the worker's name on the list of flu deaths in the newspaper. There were weeks when that list had 500 names on it. The city sent out wagons to pick up the bodies, but after a while the drivers were afraid to go inside any place where there was sickness, so people left corpses out on the porches and even on the sidewalk. A lot of the dead were buried in unmarked graves. It was a real plague, and not so long ago. The health department closed the movie houses and concert halls and told people to stay away from crowds. Nobody should have been out dancing, but a lot of people ignored all the warnings. My friend Rose was one of them. Betty took Myron and Jacob out of school even before the health department closed them, and she kept them inside. My mother put a red string on all the doorknobs to keep out the evil eye. It didn't help. One morning, Myron said he had a terrible headache and couldn't get out of bed. Levine said he would take care of him and told Betty to take Lenny and Jacob downstairs and stay there. But she left them with my mother and ran back to be with Myron, too. We weren't allowed near him, but I went up and left them food in the kitchen, trying to hear what was going on in the back bedroom. When I went back later, nobody had touched a crumb, and I heard them in the bathroom with Myron, trying to cool him down in the bathtub. At night, I heard Myron coughing and moaning, and Levine begging him to hang on. Downstairs, Jacob was frantic and kept asking, "Where was Mommy and Daddy? Where was Myron?" Lenny was quiet. Even though he was barely a year old, he knew something was wrong. No one was paying attention to him, not even my father. But he didn't make a fuss. He just watched us with big eyes. Papa couldn't sit still anymore and went out to find a doctor, even though there weren't any. He was only gone an hour, but when he got back, we had to tell him that Myron was gone. He was 9 years old. A few hours after Myron died, Betty came downstairs. All she wanted was to see the boys. Jacob ran to her and hugged her. She wouldn't let go. Betty picked him up and whispered, "How's my Jakey? How's my Jake?" Mama said, "They both ate a good dinner, but Lenny was a little cranky, so I put him to sleep in my bed." Betty dropped Jake and ran to the other room. She screamed, "He's blue!" She took Lenny upstairs, and Jacob tried to follow her, but I caught him and held him tight while he screamed and sobbed and finally cried himself to sleep. Mama, Papa, and I sat at the table most of the night, not talking or looking at each other, listening for sounds from upstairs. When I brought hot tea upstairs, Levine met me in the kitchen and said, "He seems a little better." He took some water and smiled. I fell asleep with my clothes on and woke up before it was light. Lying in bed, I listened to the footsteps overhead, back and forth, from one end of the apartment to the other. They took turns. Betty walked faster than Levine, but they followed the same path, back and forth, steady as a heartbeat. It went on like that until the afternoon. When the footsteps stopped, we all looked at the ceiling. Papa said a blessing. Mama threw a dish towel over her head and wailed. Jake put his head on my lap. After a little while, I tiptoed upstairs and walked through Betty's apartment. In her house, it was always immaculate, nothing out of place. But with the natural order of things all upside down, children dying before parents, everything she did to keep things in order looked wasted and pathetic. I stopped at the doorway to the boys' room. A breeze from the open window ruffled the sheet covering Myron's body. In the other bedroom, Betty was curled up on the bed, facing the wall. Levine sat with his back to her, staring at the cradle, which was covered with a blanket. He looked at me with dead eyes, and I could feel the sadness coming off him, like cold air on my face. They had lost 2 children in 2 days. How do you go on after that? Coffins and hearses were impossible to come by, but somehow my father managed to get both, and the next day we went to the cemetery, me, Papa, and Levine. The city went by in a blur, but we slowed down when we passed through a little town where people were pushing baby carriages under red and yellow leaves, just as if it were another nice day in October. It seemed like we'd been driving for hours when the driver turned down a dirt road and through a field of weeds to a stand of scrawny trees that marked the cemetery, the saddest, most forlorn place I'd ever seen. 2 men with shovels were waiting for us, and 2 big mounds of dirt. Myron had turned into a nice kid. Betty hadn't let him get away with anything, but she also hugged him a lot. She called him Mike, and he called her Ma, and did his chores without being asked. He was good in arithmetic. His top front tooth was a little crooked. He had a nice singing voice. That was Myron. We followed his coffin from the hearse to the grave, where the men lowered the half-sized casket into the ground and waited for Levine to pick up the spade. But he didn't move. He couldn't. So Papa stepped forward and shoveled a little bit of dirt into the hole, but so gently it sounded like rain on the coffin. When he was finished, Levine and my father said Kaddish. The driver came back carrying something that from the distance looked like a hatbox. When Levine saw it, he made a noise like a wild animal caught in a trap. Lenny had been born with a head of silky brown hair. He smiled at everyone, and Betty joked that he was going to be a politician when he grew up. He liked peas, and his first word was ball. That was Lenny. He and Myron were like silhouette portraits cut out of black paper, like shadows of the people they might have been if they'd grown up. Papa tried to force the shovel into Levine's hands to bury the baby. I couldn't watch anymore, and went looking for Celia's grave. I had a stone for her in my pocket. I'd found it on the beach in Rockport and carried it around with me ever since. It was white and smooth, almost as round as a pearl. I put it on top of her gravestone and said, "I'm sorry." Papa came and put a plain brown pebble next to mine. He traced Celia's name with his finger. "Your mother said Celia shouldn't come to America with me. She thought she was too delicate. But Mama had another baby on the way, and her mother was sick, too. I thought it would be easier for her if I took both girls." He wiped his eyes. "She would still be alive if I'd left her there." Levine walked over to us. Papa put an arm around his shoulder for a moment before he started back to the car. Levine hadn't shaved or combed his hair for 4 days, and his face was swollen. He put a 3rd stone on Celia's headstone and whispered, "She would be alive if I hadn't married her." "It wasn't your fault," I said. Like it wasn't my father's fault. And for the first time since she died, I thought, maybe it wasn't all my fault either. I was still gun-shy about men. Nobody talked about the epidemic when it was over, but everyone was carrying around their own load of heartache, acting as if no one had died. I felt like I was skating on a pond that wasn't frozen all the way through, and if anyone asked me, "How's the family?" the ice would break. People kept saying, "Life goes on." Sometimes that sounded like a wish, and sometimes it felt like an order. I wanted to scream, "Life goes on? Not for everyone, it doesn't." But when Betty said she was pregnant again, "Life goes on" became a fact, and I found myself looking forward to the new baby in a whole different way. She had another boy, Eddie, a blue-eyed blonde who laughed, I swear, from the day he was born, and I finally understood why people got so silly about infants. From the beginning, he seemed to like me, too. I was the only one who could settle him down when he got fussy. Betty got a kick out of that. Auntie Addie to the rescue. My mother was thrilled with the new baby, but my father would hardly look at him. Papa was never the same after Lenny died. I was spending more and more time upstairs with Betty. I don't know where she learned how to be such a good mother. She was strict about manners in school, but she would get down on the floor and play with her boys, let them climb all over her, anything for fun. And Levine thought she walked on water. I finally forgave Betty for being happy in the life that had been a disaster for Celia. I had stopped hating Levine a long time ago, but for some reason I could never get myself to call him Herman. When the war ended, the big orders stopped coming, and Levine had to lay off half his workers. He slipped each of them a $20 bill, which was a lot then, but he felt so bad about firing people that he started losing weight. Betty wasn't going to stand for that. She told him to get out of the schmata business and go into real estate. Levine said he'd give it a try, but the first building he bought looked like a big mistake. It was a wreck of a house on a rundown street, but it was cheap and close to downtown. Location, 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 right? He sold it a few months later for 3 times what he paid. Levine went around telling people, "I made a killing and I didn't hurt anyone." So he sold the shirt factory and started over in a one-room office downtown. The business was just the two of us, and he was mostly out walking around the city talking to people, getting to know the neighborhoods and figuring out where to buy property he could sell at a higher price later. My job was to wait for the phone to ring and look through the newspapers for stories about fires and foreclosures, anything that might mean someone was selling. Of course, I read the obituaries, but I even looked at the sports pages because once in a while, players would have to sell a house in a hurry. From all that reading, I got to be an expert on Boston politics, the social set, and the Red Sox. I could also tell you anything you wanted to know about Fatty Arbuckle's drinking problem, the League of Nations, and the fight over prohibition. I got in the habit of reading a newspaper even when I wasn't at work, because it made me feel like I was living in a bigger world. I never stopped, not even during the Depression. I just read them a day late. One time, I saw a story about three brothers who were suing each other over their family's fish store in Roxbury, a place Jews were starting to move to. From what I could tell, none of the brothers wanted to run the business, so I told Levine to see if they'd sell it to him and split the money. He took my advice, bought and sold the store, and made a bundle. For that, he gave me a nice raise and a promotion to executive secretary. I was going to Saturday Club, but the girls I knew were getting married and having children. Even the younger members were dropping like flies, as Gussie put it. Gussie was a real career woman by then. After a few years at Simmons, she went on to the Porsche School of Law, which was women only, and passed the bar on her first try. When no one would hire a lady lawyer, she went out on her own. Her first client was a woman who wanted to open a hat store but didn't know anything about banks or leases. Soon, Gussie had a specialty as the lawyer for women who wanted to start their own businesses, and for a long time, she never had to pay for cake, dresses, or flowers. Irene, Gussie, and I all liked our jobs and didn't talk about men all the time, so Gussie started calling us the Three Musketeers. But work didn't mean the same thing for Irene and me as it did for her. Gussie was a lawyer with every fiber of her being. Irene was a supervisor at the telephone company with 30 girls under her, but it was still just a job, and she didn't want to do it for the rest of her life. And although Irene didn't talk about it in front of Gussie, she did go out with men. After she bobbed her hair, like everyone except me at that point, her green eyes looked twice as big and pretty. But the moment any man told her what she should or shouldn't do, he was finished. As for me, I would have preferred not working for Levine, but how could I complain about a job where I got to read most of the day? I was still gun-shy about men because of the Coast Guard schmuck, but I was still as romantically inclined as any 20-year-old girl who went to the movies. And by then, I knew not all marriages were as bad as my parents. Betty and Levine were happy, and I liked Helen's husband, Charlie, who was a sucker for that little girl, Rosie. They named her after our friend Rose, who died of the flu. And you want to hear something strange? The baby was born with red hair. Nobody in either family had red hair, and they had picked out the name when Helen was still pregnant. But Rosie came out a redhead. Every now and then, Betty would try to get me to go out on a date. There's nothing wrong with books, but you could also go out with a fellow once in a while, have a nice meal, why not? The one time I made the mistake of saying, "I suppose you have someone in mind," she was ready for me, and 2 days later, I was eating steak with a man who sold children's shoes. The next morning, before I was even out of bed, Betty came to my room asking about my rendezvous. I said it was very educational, and did she know that Boston was the center of the children's shoe business, and that you can sell more pairs of shoes to girls, but you can charge more for boys, and that shoemakers in Massachusetts were going to put themselves out of business if they kept raising their prices. Betty said, "Okay, so he didn't sweep you off your feet, so what? You got out of the house and the food was good, so it wasn't a complete waste." She also said that I had to kiss a lot of frogs before I found a prince and lined me up with a high school teacher. He sounded interesting, but turned out to be a nudnik too. Almost the first thing he said when we sat down was that he'd been cheated out of a promotion to be principal, and the only reason is because I'm Jewish. Meanwhile, he yelled at the waiter for forgetting the ketchup, for bringing him coffee without cream, and for being slow with the bill. I told Betty they probably didn't give him the job because he was a jerk. The next one was a good-looking man who was in dental school. He took me to a beautiful white tablecloth restaurant, but by the time I'd finished my lamb chop, I knew I was there only as a favor to one of Levine's business friends. At least the dentist was honest. He said he needed a wife with connections. "I know that sounds bad, but it's the only way I'll be able to set myself up in practice, and it's not like money would be the only condition." I said, "I guess you'd also want two arms and two legs?" For spite, I ordered the most expensive dessert on the menu, the one with the cherries that they light on fire. You know the saying about how revenge tastes better cold? Well, it tastes just as good warm. Betty was ready with a nice quiet bookkeeper, but I said I didn't want to meet any more frogs. "So what are you going to do?" she said. "Sit around the house and listen to Mama call you an old maid and say I told you so and that you're too smart for your own good?" Betty kept hawking me about going out again until I said, "Would you leave me alone if I go back to night school?" She said that would be okay, but that she wasn't going to stop nagging me until I signed up and started class. It was annoying how she treated me like I was one of her children and not a grown woman, but it was a good thing, too. I thought he was sweet, and that I was sweet on him. I ran into Ernie Goldman on the trolley, but I wouldn't have recognized him if he hadn't introduced himself. He looked 10 years older than the last time I'd seen him, which was only a few years earlier in the Shakespeare class. He was so pale and skinny, I thought he'd been sick. But then I saw the cane, which meant he'd probably been overseas in the war. I asked what he was doing, and he said he was working in his father's scrap metal business. When I told him I was on my way to class at Simmons, he said, "I figured you for a college girl. You always ask the best questions." When I said that was one of the nicest compliments I'd ever had, all the lines around his mouth relaxed, and his whole face rearranged itself into a smile that reached up into his eyes. When a shy person smiles, it's like the sun coming out. We got to my stop and said goodbye, and honestly, I didn't give him a second thought. But the next morning, there was a bouquet of roses on my desk. The note said, "May I take you to dinner on Saturday, Ernie Goldman?" 5 minutes later, the phone rang and Betty said, "Herman says you got roses from Ernie Goldman. Who is he? Do I know him?" He asked me to pick the restaurant. Betty said the Marliave was nice, but when we got there, I was mortified. The dining room was lit with candles and all the tables were full of couples holding hands and whispering. There was even a violin player walking around playing schmaltzy music. I was afraid Ernie would think I was being pushy, but he didn't seem to take it that way. He held out my chair and said he liked how quiet the place was. I knew Ernie was shy, so I'd thought up some questions to get him talking, but he managed to turn them all around, and I wound up doing most of the talking while he leaned forward and watched my face as if he was afraid of missing something. It was very flattering, and when I got him to smile, I felt like I'd won the lottery. By the end of the evening, I thought he was sweet, and that I was sweet on him. We saw each other once a week after that, and when he found out that I usually went to Saturday Club, he asked if I would prefer we go out on Sundays instead. He was thoughtful that way. Nothing like the blowhards I'd been fixed up with, and the complete opposite of you-know-who. Ernie was formal, even a little stiff, but I didn't hold it against him. I was pretty sure it had something to do with his being wounded. But when I asked where he'd been in the war, he shook his head. The doctors said I should put it all behind me. I didn't ask again. When I think back, I get mad at what they did to those poor men. Ernie must have had PTSD. They called it shell shock, and the doctors told him to keep it all bottled up inside. They didn't know any better, but it was like treating syphilis with candy bars. A few weeks after we started going out, I finally got up the nerve to get my hair cut. The barber said I was lucky. My hair was so thick and wavy it looked like I'd had it marcelled. Of course, what I wanted was straight hair with big spit curls on each side, but that would have taken a pound of pomade. No girl is ever happy with her own hair, is she? But I did look good, if I say so myself. On the way home, a stranger actually stopped me on the street and asked if I was single. When Ernie didn't notice my haircut at all, I was hurt. Betty just shrugged and told me not to worry about it. Typical man. But I was starting to wonder about Ernie. It's not like I wanted him to make a pass at me, but after 3 months, he hadn't even kissed me on the cheek. Once when we were at the movies and he had his hand on the armrest, I put my hand on top of his. He didn't pull away, but he didn't take it either, and I felt like an idiot. And then there was the day at the art museum. I'd gotten 2 postcards in 1 day from Philomena, so I told Ernie I'd rather go look at the paintings than go to a matinee. He said okay, like he did to everything I suggested. But when we got off the trolley, I saw he was limping more than usual. I asked if he wanted to sit down and rest, and he snapped. And I mean like one of those turtles that bite. Don't talk to me like that. I pointed out some of the paintings Philomena had shown me, but Ernie didn't seem interested in anything. So after a little while, I said we should leave. We were on our way out when he stopped and stared at a big painting of a young man floating in the sea. Right next to him was a huge shark with its mouth wide open, like he was getting ready to bite the man's head off. Some men in a boat were trying to rescue him, but it looked like they were too late. His skin was gray and his eyes were glassy. It was gruesome. One look was enough for me, but Ernie couldn't take his eyes off it. "It's from a true story," he said. "You see the blood in the water there? Do you see that his foot is missing?" "What an awful way to die," I said. But he didn't die. Ernie limped across the gallery to a bench facing the painting, and I sat down with him. He was still staring at the painting. This was the first place my nurse took me when I got out of the wheelchair. She said if Watson could be the mayor of London without a foot, there was no reason I couldn't get myself up and out of the house. "And you did," I said. Ernie put his elbows on his knees and held his head in his hands and sat like that for a long time. He didn't answer me when I said we should go, and eventually one of the guards came over to see if something was wrong. Ernie didn't say another word all day. That night, I decided to break it off. I felt guilty, like I was abandoning a puppy I had adopted. And there was even something unpatriotic about walking away from a veteran of the war, but Ernie had been getting moodier and quieter, and then there was the physical element, or the complete lack of it. The next morning, Ernie called me at work and said how much he enjoyed our time at the museum, as if nothing had happened. He asked if I'd go to the movies with him on Sunday, but I said I couldn't because I was going to Revere Beach with Betty and the family. He told me he didn't like going to the shore, so I thought I was off the hook. But later that day, I got a bunch of daisies, and the note said, "Maybe you could teach me how to like the beach." It was so sweet, I thought, okay, one more chance. But by the weekend, I was praying it would rain so I wouldn't have to see him again. No such luck. Sunday was sunny and hot, and Ernie met me with a daisy in his hand. "You look pretty," he said, and I could see how hard he was trying. "Your hair is pretty, too." There wasn't room in Levine's car for us to ride with them, but I wanted to take the trolley anyway. With everyone going to the beach, it was like a party. There were hampers in the aisles and children running around and strangers debating where to get the best ice cream. I thought it was fun, but Ernie pulled his hat low on his forehead to shut it all out. I told him it would be better once we got off, but it wasn't. The boardwalk was mobbed like downtown at Christmas, only with the roller coaster roaring overhead. The beach was even worse. It was like an obstacle course for blankets and people. It was hard for him to walk on sand, and the cane didn't help at all. When we found Betty and Levine, Eddie shrieked and held out his arms for me to pick him up. Jake was jumping up and down. "Aunt Addie, tell Pop to let me go to the arcade. I'll win a toy for Eddie. Tell him I'm big enough to go by myself." Betty said, "Take him to the arcade, Herman. I have company now, so you don't have to worry about me." She was very pregnant and trying to cool off with a big straw fan. The baby makes me even hotter than usual. At least I don't have swollen ankles like when I was pregnant before. Herman thinks it means I'm having a girl, which is what he wants. She patted her belly. "He's moving around just as much as my other boys. But no matter what comes out, this is the last one." I could see that Ernie was mortified by the way she was talking about her body. He didn't know where to look and was sweating through his jacket. I asked Betty if she'd be okay for a few minutes if we walked to the water to find a breeze. Wasn't any cooler there. We ended up near a bunch of boys who were setting off firecrackers left over from the 4th of July. The popping made Ernie nervous, so we started back, and that's when the first rocket exploded over our heads. Ernie jumped and tried to walk faster. The next blast was so strong, I could feel it in my chest, and baby started crying. Ernie threw himself down on the sand face first, his hands around the back of his head. I crouched over him and said it was just kids making noise, but then a whole string of loud explosions went off, echoing up and down the beach. Ernie pulled himself up and ran, dragging his bad leg behind him. He was running blind with his head down and his hands over his ears, so he had no idea that he'd knocked a little boy to the ground or that the boy's father was chasing him. He was a short man with muscular legs, and it took him no time to catch up to poor lame Ernie in his shoes full of sand. He tackled Ernie, who curled up in a ball and started making those terrible choking noises men make when they cry. The man stood over him for a moment, but then he kneeled down and started patting Ernie on the back, saying things like, "It's all right now, soldier. I know. I was there too. But it's all right now. You're home." When he noticed me holding Ernie's hat and cane, he said, "Are you the wife?" "Friend of the family," I said, ashamed of how fast I'd answered so no one would think I was married to this poor lunatic. "What should I do?" "Let's get him out of here," he said, and hoisted Ernie up by the armpits and dragged him toward the boardwalk. A man with an empty sleeve met us and said, "There's a police car down by the carousel." I said I'd go, ran down the street as fast as I could. When the cops heard that Ernie was a veteran, they turned on the siren. They were very kind to him as they got him into the back seat. They must have been in the war, too. Betty said, "I hope you aren't taking this too hard. I never thought he was right for you." "I should have ended it a long time ago," I said. "I was going out with him for something to do. God, that sounds so awful." "Don't be so hard on yourself. He wasn't in love with you either." That didn't make me feel any better. I never saw Ernie again. His parents sent him to a sanitarium in Colorado. I heard they'd sold everything, moved out there to be with him. It was a long time before I even thought about going out again. First Harold, then Ernie. It was pretty clear I didn't have any talent at picking men. If I wasn't so busy, I would have felt sorry for myself. Levine went into business with Morris Silverman, who was a much bigger fish in Boston real estate, and also a very nice guy. Everybody liked Mo Silverman. The only problem was that he already had 3 girls in his office, and there wasn't enough work for 4 secretaries. Betty wanted him to fire one of his girls. "I'm sure you're a better typist." But to me, it wasn't a problem at all. I had wanted to change jobs for a long time. I hadn't done anything about it because no one was going to pay me as much as Levine, and also it would have made a big stink at home. So this was a good thing. Gussie was always saying she could get me a job with a judge or one of her businesswomen, and Miss Chevalier was working for the Boston Public Library, so I could ask her to recommend me for a job there. When Silverman said he wanted to talk to me about the situation, I was ready to tell him there were no hard feelings. But instead of letting me go, he asked if I could just wait a few months. One of his girls was getting married and leaving in September, but he didn't want to let her go sooner because she was paying for the wedding herself. "She's an orphan," he said, and he offered to pay me a little something on the side. It would be our little secret, and I would start again in the fall. That was a mensch, even if he did ruin my escape plan. Betty thought it was perfect timing. She said I could spend the summer at home with her and the boys. "It'll be good practice for you when you have your own children." She needed help with the twins, who were 2 years old at the time. I guess they would have been your second cousins, Richie and Carl. Eddie was still a little kid, too. Jake was 10 by then. I think he was Betty's favorite, and I don't think anybody in the neighborhood ever knew that he wasn't her natural son. But spending 3 months with them and around my mother would have given me a nervous breakdown. Mama never let up. I read too many books. I had too many friends. I dressed like a floozy. It was selfish to waste money on movies, and I was an ingrate because I wouldn't answer her in Yiddish like Betty. Mama didn't call her Betty the whore anymore, although behind her back it was Betty the climber, and Betty who thinks she's better than you and me. Once, as a kind of peace offering, I asked her in Yiddish if she needed anything from the store, and all she did was make fun of my pronunciation. Betty let that kind of thing roll off her back, but it always got my heart racing, like I was being chased, and if she started in at night, I couldn't fall asleep. There was nothing I could do to please my mother, never mind that I was paying most of the rent. When I told Gussie what was going on and that I might get stuck babysitting for Betty until September, she said, "You could go to Rockport Lodge for the summer." I thought she was joking. I hadn't been to Rockport since the summer Philomena fell in love with a sculptor. Gussie not only went every year, she knew half the women on the lodge's board of directors, which is how she knew that the girl who had been hired to make the beds and sweep the halls had quit at the last minute. "It's not a great job, and the pay is lousy, but it might be better than staying home and changing diapers. By the time you get back, I'll try to have something better for you." It sounded too good to be true. Room and board, living away from home for the summer in the most beautiful place I'd ever seen. Gussie made a phone call, and I was hired. I told my parents I had a job as the assistant to the director at Rockport Lodge, which is sort of true and sounded better than cleaning lady. My father had no opinion, but of course my mother thought it was terrible. Why would I do such a thing when my sister needed me? Who would be watching me? She used two Yiddish words for tramp I'd never heard before. Betty told me to go. "You're only young once. Never mind what I said. You don't need to practice on my kids. They already love you to pieces." But because Betty was Betty, she also said, "Of course, they'd like to have some cousins already." I started crossing off days on the calendar. I got a valise and repacked it 100 times. Buying that train ticket made me feel like a world traveler. The director of Rockport Lodge that summer was Miss Gloria Lettuce. Not a youngster, that one. She had tiny eyes and the biggest bosom I'd ever seen. She was also very full of herself. Before I could put down my suitcase, she said, "Come along," showed me to a closet full of buckets and mops, some for the bathroom only, some for the stairs and hallways. I was still carrying my bag when we went to see the linen cabinet, which I had to keep in the same exact order at all times, and then outside to the garbage bins, where I would empty waste baskets every morning. I had never seen the annex, which was a new one-story building behind the main house, like a long cabin with unpainted rooms for 20 or 30 more girls. That's when I started to realize how much work I was in for. In the kitchen, Miss Lettuce handed me over to Mrs. Morse, who hadn't changed at all. She took one look at me and sighed. "Not very strong, are you? I just hope you don't run away after the first week like the last girl." I promised I'd be there all summer, but I could tell she didn't believe me. She showed me my room, which was the old pantry, and only big enough for a cot, a stool, and a few pegs for my clothes, and it was right next to the stove, so when the oven was on, I had to get out of there or I would bake too. After a week, I thought I might have been better off with 4 boys than 60 girls who never picked up their magazines and were always losing their socks and hankies. I didn't understand how they could get their bathrooms so dirty, or how they managed to track in pounds, and I'm not exaggerating, of sand. I never stopped sweeping. If I wasn't so busy, I would have felt sorry for myself. But it wasn't until the first Saturday changeover that I understood why that other girl had run away. As soon as the group that was leaving brought their suitcases downstairs, I started stripping and making beds, dusting and mopping floors and carrying out heaps of trash. I lugged baskets and baskets of dirty linen to the laundry shed, where a tall African-American lady with white hair was boiling a huge pot of water. I barely finished before the next group arrived. I went to lie down and ended up sleeping straight through supper. Mrs. Morse was offended that someone could be too tired to eat her food, so she told Miss Lettuce that either she'd get me some help on Saturdays or she would not be back the next summer. "And I will tell the board that you were the reason why." Lucy Miller showed up the very next week. I couldn't imagine how a bony 13-year-old kid with blonde pigtails would be much help, but she'd been cleaning up after 6 brothers her whole life, so she could strip and make a bed in half the time it took me. Thanks to her, I never missed a Saturday lunch out of tiredness again. And believe me, that was a meal I didn't want to miss. The food in the kitchen was better than what they got in the dining room, especially Saturday lunch. When we finished eating, Hannah, the washerwoman, tipped her chair back on two legs and said, "That was a real Sunday dinner we had, even if it's only Saturday." I had never sat down with a black person before, and I was a little shy of her at first. I had read Uncle Tom's Cabin, so what was I going to say to someone whose grandmother had probably been a slave? But Hannah was easy to be around and a great storyteller. She even got Mrs. Morse to laugh about the summer people in the big houses in town. They seemed to think that the locals were deaf, blind, and too stupid to see that Father was drunk every night, or young Miss was doing more than just talking to the gardener. After a few weeks, my arms and legs were stronger, and I wasn't dead tired at the end of the day. So one evening when the girls were playing charades, I changed clothes and went to join in. There were a lot of puzzled faces when I walked into the parlor, but once they figured out that I was the girl who washed the toilets, nobody would look me in the eye. I don't think they were being mean. If the cleaning girl had shown up for charades when I was a guest at Rockport Lodge, I probably would have done the same thing. More out of embarrassment than snobbery, I hope. There must have been someone doing the cleaning when I was there on vacation, but I can't remember seeing her. To this day, whenever I lay eyes on a chambermaid, I smile and say hello. After that, if there was music or a lecture I wanted to hear, I pulled up a chair on the porch and listened through the window. On quiet nights when it was really dark, Mrs. Morse gave me an oil lamp so I could sit out where it was cool and read a book. A girl should always have her own money. Where I grew up, it would have been bad manners to sit in a woman's kitchen without asking about her children and her parents, her opinion of the neighbors, even her digestion. Mrs. Morse and I talked about the weather and what was on tomorrow's menu, and that was it. But on Friday nights, when she stayed late to get ahead on the weekend baking, I watched her make bread, rolls, cakes, and cookies, and she'd tell me how she came up with her recipes and why she used butter for some things and lard for others. She kept her eyes on the dough or the batter and chatted away like a different person, a happier person. Mrs. Morse made pie for the girls the first week, but Miss Lettuce decided it wasn't fancy enough for the dining room, so she baked them just for us in the kitchen. I told Mrs. Morse I'd eat her pie 3 times a day if I could. She said, "Too much of a good thing can make you bilious," but after that she always gave me the biggest slice. I knew Mrs. Morse liked me, even if she didn't say so. She told me to get out of the lodge in the evening sometimes. "Go into town, have an ice cream, look at the shops, Lucy can show you around." But Lucy was too young and silly, and I told Mrs. Morse that I was saving my money. She approved. A girl should always have her own money, so she's never beholden to anyone. I said that was very modern of her, but she didn't think so. As far as I can tell, common sense hasn't been in fashion for a long time. What I knew about Mrs. Morse, and it wasn't much, came from Lucy, whose grandmother was a second cousin or something. I think everyone in Rockport was related to each other. Her first name was Margaret, and her husband had died when she was young. She had a son named George, who was a disappointment. But Lucy forgot to mention that Mrs. Morse had a sister named Elizabeth, who I met when she stopped by one Sunday afternoon after church. I saw the resemblance right away: high foreheads, close-set gray eyes, and thick iron-gray hair. But Margaret Morse was round and mild, where Elizabeth Stiles was thin and suspicious. She looked right over my head when I said, "Nice to meet you." I went outside so the two of them could talk in private, but Mrs. Stiles was so deaf I might as well have been sitting at the table with them. She shouted, "I can't believe you're back here again." Mrs. Morse said, "It suits me," and that she couldn't afford to stop working. Mrs. Stiles thought she could do better in one of the big summer kitchens out on the Eastern Point, but Mrs. Morse liked being in charge of her own kitchen and going home to her own bed at night. "And don't worry about the money. I'm doing just fine." Mrs. Stiles said, "I still don't know how you stand it around here. All those foreigners would give me the willies." Mrs. Morse lowered her voice a little. "At first I thought the Italians would steal. I was sure the Irish would smell bad, and I was a little afraid of the Jews, but after all these years, I tell you, some of them are nicer than Americans."
"These days they're all trying to be flippers."
"Flappers," Mrs. Morse said. "Our mother would have fainted dead away to see all the leg they're showing." Mrs. Stiles said, "Mother would have taken a stick to them. Things were better back then." Mrs. Morse said she thought some things were better nowadays, but Mrs. Stiles didn't see it. Summer people had ruined the town, and it was taking your life in your hands to cross the street, what with all the automobiles. "And those bathing costumes, you can see all the way up to you-know-where. It's terrible." Mrs. Morse said, "Well, there's nothing you can do about it, so why don't I just cut you a nice piece of chocolate cake?" She could fix almost anything with a piece of cake. Or pie. It's not your problem, Addie. On the hottest nights, when my room was stifling, I took my pillow and blanket to the porch, made a bed out of chairs and little tables. When you're young, you can sleep anywhere. One night when I was out there, the sound of the kitchen door woke me up. We never locked it, and I figured that one of the upstairs girls had been gallivanting. But when I went inside for a glass of water, Mrs. Morse was holding onto the back of a chair, shaking all over, and there was blood on her mouth. I made her sit down and ran a washcloth under the cold water for her face. I asked if she wanted me to get Mrs. Lettuce or her sister, but she shook her head. After we both calmed down, I did a pretty good imitation of Betty and ordered her to stay over and sleep in my bed. I took the biggest knife I could find and went back to the porch to keep watch. I didn't have to ask who had hurt her. Hannah said that Mrs. Morse's son was mixed up with the rum running going on all over Cape Ann. Canadian boats full of liquor would unload onto smaller boats off the coast, and the locals who ferried the stuff in made good money delivering booze to hoodlums who came up from Boston. Men like George Moore skimmed bottles to sell to the rich summer people who never gave up their cocktails during Prohibition. But if too much went missing, well, those suppliers were very tough characters. Mrs. Moore stayed in the kitchen the next day and kept her head down, so I was the only one who saw her swollen lip and the bruise on her jaw. She went home after supper, but she was back with a valise after lights out. She said she was going to sleep on the porch, but I knew she couldn't risk Miss Lettuce finding her. That woman was like a one-woman vice squad. The summer before, a girl had been sent home for drinking, and another had eloped from the lodge, so she was taking extra care to protect our reputation. No hanky-panky of any kind would be tolerated, which was the reason I could talk Mrs. Morse into staying in my room. I camped out on the porch, and when I heard someone walking toward the house, I ran inside. Mrs. Morse was waiting at the door, and I begged her to go upstairs. She wasn't having that. "You go. I'm going to take care of this." I wasn't going to win that argument, so I went, but only as far as the dining room where I could keep an eye on her. She let him in when he started kicking the door. George Morse was an inch or two taller than his mother and broad in the shoulders, with big, meaty hands that he clenched and unclenched like he was getting ready to punch someone. I could smell the booze on him from the other room. They argued in whispers for a few minutes, and then Mrs. Morse sank into a chair with her face turned away from George, who hung over her and ranted. "You know they're gonna kill me if I don't get them the money.
What do you need it for anyway? I know about your goddamn nest egg, so don't tell me you don't have any. You're just a stingy old woman with one foot in the grave anyway. What kind of mother won't save her son? Do you want to see me dead? Is that it? If you don't give me that money, I'm going to burn down the house. When he grabbed her wrist, I ran into the kitchen and said, "Leave her alone." He looked me up and down and got a sickening look on his face. "Who's this little dish?" I told him to get out or I'd call the police. He just laughed. "You're not bad looking. Maybe if you come outside and play patty cake with me, I'll let it go for tonight." Mrs. Morse said, "Let her be, George." He let go of her wrist and came toward me. "Come on, missy. I got a little rum left, or maybe you like wine? I can get that, too. I'm not a bad guy. Just got myself into a little jam." He was right up against me, breathing into my face. "Tell her, Ma. Tell her I'm a nice guy." But Mrs. Morse had gotten a knife and was behind him, jabbing him in the back. When he tried to turn around, she poked him hard enough to make him yelp. "I'll run you through if I have to," she whispered, using the knife to get him to the door. Before he left, he said, "Next time I'll bring my own knife, and I won't be so polite with your little friend." I didn't realize how scared I was until he was gone. My voice squeaked when I said we should call the police, but Mrs. Morse said it wouldn't help. The rum runners and the cops were in cahoots. I said, "So what are we going to do?" She patted my hand. "It's not your problem, Addie. Go to sleep now. I'm going to sit here for a while." There was no sleeping that night. I kept hearing the awful things George had said to me and to his mother. I could see the ugly look on his face and the bruise on Mrs. Morse's jaw, and it made me remember a woman from Levine's factory who came to work every Monday morning with a black eye or a swollen lip. Everyone pretended not to see it. No one said a word, including me. What could I say? Call the police? If they did come, they were gone after a few minutes. Leave the bomb? How could she feed her children on her own? But with my own eyes, I had seen George hurt Mrs. Morse. I knew I couldn't let it happen again, but I had no idea how to stop it. On Saturday, I met Bess Sparber, who knew Gussie from the courthouse. She was staying at the lodge that week and wanted to say hello and see how I was doing. She was a short blonde with a handshake like a longshoreman's. She had a little space between her front teeth, which I always think makes a person look honest. I was desperate to talk to someone and told her what was happening to Mrs. Morse. She said, "This happens all the time. I hear things in court that would make you sick to your stomach. A woman who lost an eye to a beating. A little boy who had maggots in the strap marks on his back. Home, sweet home, don't make me laugh." She said she'd help in any way she could and that she'd get others to pitch in, too. That gave me the idea to find out who was staying in the room right over the kitchen. George hadn't shown his face for a few days, but I knew he'd be back. So I locked the kitchen door at night to have some warning and kept a knife and broom handy. The moment I heard his footsteps, I tapped the ceiling with my broom handle and then waited to open the door until George started hollering. As soon as he came in, a dozen girls holding croquet mallets and tennis rackets surrounded him. Girls kept coming, quiet as mice, until they filled the room. The only sounds were his breathing and Bess smacking a baseball bat across the palm of her hand. When George spotted Mrs. Morse standing at the door, he lunged at her, butting his shoulder into the girl next to him like a football player. It must have hurt, but she didn't budge, and the others closed in until he was trapped. Mrs. Morse told him to get out. George called her an old bitch and worse, and kept throwing himself toward her, but the girls didn't give, and eventually they pushed him back out the door. After the lock clicked, there was a big sigh of relief. Bess and I wanted to get everyone out of there as quickly as possible, but Mrs. Morse had to shake hands with each and every girl first. In the morning, Bess came to the kitchen and said,
That was terrific, but now what are you going to do?
We might try to pull the same stunt for a few nights, but then a whole new group of girls would arrive and they might not be so willing. Or someone might let the cat out of the bag and get Mrs. Morse in trouble. Or George could bring a gun. I had to get help from someone local, and the only people I knew to trust aside from Mrs. Morse were Hannah and Lucy. Hannah laughed when I told her how we got George out of the kitchen. She said, "Wish I could have seen his face," and said I should talk to Lucy because she knew everyone in town. Lucy got very quiet when I told her what was going on. "George Morse is a shitheel," she said. "He grabbed me between the legs when I was 10 years old, and I still feel dirty from it. You tell Mrs. Morse not to worry anymore." I'm not exactly sure what happened, but Lucy talked to her Uncle Ned, a temperance man who wasn't shy about using axes, and not just on whiskey barrels. Ned's drunken father had broken his nose when he was a boy, so he saw it as his calling to protect the weak, by whatever means necessary. A week went by without a visit from George. Mrs. Morse stopped jumping up every time the door opened and went back to sleeping in her own house. Another week passed, and it seemed that George Morse had vanished from the face of the earth, but since nobody wanted to see him, nobody went looking for him. There was a rumor about a body washing up on Long Beach, but I didn't see anything about it in the newspaper. Besides, he could have gone to Salem or Boston or anywhere. Mrs. Morse never mentioned her son again in my hearing, but I had pie for breakfast every day for the rest of the summer.